calling the toads the antinomian fire this time. The bone man dances circles round the subterranean gloom, paints pink and blue and purple until he fills the room with the smell of roses and a pandemonium moon. There is a struggle going on for our minds, the minds of the world people. Every form of expression is being attacked. The attack is overt and subtle, explicit and implicit. The attack manifests as silent persecution, as mind manipulation, as censorship, as fear. The attack is pervasive. Most people, being asleep, are not even aware of the attack until their doors are broken down. In the face of fear, the poet, the writer, the artist, the composer, the musician, the filmmaker can and must speak out. Can and must act. I believe in individuals who are awake, who fight for freedom. I believe in nonviolent fighting, which creates new forms, new voices, which, by their own being and expression and action, stand against reaction, against fundamentalism, against violence, against war. Unscrew the locks from the doors, unscrew the doors from their jams. Anne Hutchinson, William Blake, Walt Whitman, and the antinomian tradition, voices without restraint. Government shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Anne Hutchinson, cousin of John Dryden, organized a circle of women and led them in discussions of church sermons. The notion that women would even dare to discuss these sermons was considered subversive. After all, discussion leads to questions. Anne Hutchinson was convicted of traducing the ministry and banished, cast out of Boston. Antinomian emerges from the Protestant Reformation, which encourages its adherents to deny authority and resist the state when its moral position is feeble, contradictory, absurd. In legal terminology, an antinomy signifies a contradiction which, in Walt Whitman's historical moment, was the condition of slavery in a supposedly free society. The attitude of great poets is to cheer up slaves and horrify despots, Whitman wrote. He, like William Blake before him, saw his purpose as spreading to the people the original ideas of the American Republic and a revolution that had been fought to relocate sovereignty in the individual rather than in the state. In an editorial, he declared that the greatest evil is strife for gain. Yet even in his crusading journalism, he was a voice of affirmation and love. Unscrew the locks from the doors, unscrew the doors from their jams. Poetry fettered fetters the human race. It is not meters, but a meter making argument that makes a poem urge and urge and urge, always the procreant urge of the world. Through the winder of a wonder and a wilder is a welter as a warble of a warble is a world. When Whitman completed Leaves of Grass, the grass being the uncut hair of the dead, he designed it, set some of his own type, and set as his publication date the 4th of July, 1855. Leaves of Grass was disdained by critics as a mass of stupid filth, an example of New York rowdyism, grotesque and uncouth. The only favorable reviews were written by Whitman himself, pseudonymously, except, that is, for a letter from Emerson proclaiming Whitman's book as the most extraordinary piece of wit and wisdom that America has yet contributed. After Whitman was debilitated by stroke, the young Henry James attacked his work, and a generation later, in a jealous attempt to dethrone the cosmic poet who had written the American epic poem of the 19th century, Ezra Pound continued the attack on Whitman's romanticism. Whitman revised and expanded his poems for the rest of his life, but not before paying over 600 visits to hospital wards during the American Civil War. Basic surgery was amputation. Suffering was overwhelming. Whitman maintained cheerful optimism, the hallmark of his character. Whitman gave succor to the wounded. Pound's cantos reflect lifetime of antinomian resistance to the warfare state. Long after he made his peace with Whitman, Pound became pariah of modern poetry, hysterically protesting a system which created one war after another in series and system. Ezra Pound was incarcerated 12 years in the House of Bedlam, St. Elizabeth's, an asylum for the criminally insane in Washington, D.C., which years earlier, during the Civil War, had been one of the hospitals for the wounded visited. Another antinomian arriving in Paris, 1930, with $10 and a copy of Leaves of Grass, 40 years old, 20 unsuccessful years trying to write fiction during an anguished marriage, liberated himself from the middle-class values most take for granted, destitute, surviving by persuading a dozen new friends to feed and house him in rotation. Change for his conversation, fell in love with Anais Nin, another unknown writer, and began his first masterpiece, Tropic of Cancer. In his poems, Whitman simultaneously praised and condemned his country. In Cancer, Henry Miller savages America as a cesspool of the spirit, a curse on the world. Whitman introduced orgasmic potential in Song of Myself, Miller used sexual liberation as antinomian metaphor. Published in Paris, 1934, Cancer didn't appear in an American edition until 1960, when Miller was past 70. Whitman's poems were challenged by the District Attorney of Boston, but Miller's Cancer faced 50 obscenity charges resolved finally by the Supreme Court, one of the triggers of the 60s. Ezra Pound, an iconoclast far on the right of the political spectrum, Henry Miller, a Nietzschean nihilist with an anarchistic distrust of all institutions, both romantics who cannot believe with Whitman in the dream of American possibility. Whitman, Pound, Miller, all voices without restraint, crucial American influences on the Beat Generation. The Beat Generation. In the next decade, the Beat Generation will come to be recognized as the most important group of poets and writers in the history of America. Jack Kerouac, spokesperson for the Beat Generation, wrote a panoramic rhapsody infused with Whitman's identification with the common, the lowly, the downtrodden. Kerouac eulogizes his hobos and wanderers in the same natural speech which caused James Russell Lowell to keep Whitman off the shelves at Harvard. Kerouac's prose line, his long, endlessly unpunctuated, surging sentences are based on Whitman's Song of Myself. And like Whitman, Kerouac is a celebrant who remains optimistic despite all odds, despite all suffering, struggle, pain, failure. He remains optimistic because he knows the journey is perpetual and has no end. Kerouac's friend Allen Ginsberg is even closer to Whitman. Hal, written exactly a century after Song of Myself, same long line, in Whitman's case, as in Ginsberg's, form becomes a function of the freedom to which the poet aspires. The holy, 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 everything is holy, is magnificent Whitman, ah, and aha, ecstasy. Ginsberg is less ambivalent than Whitman about the human price we pay for commerce and industry, more in accord with Pound and Miller in his suspicion of Moloch, his cannibal dynamo of industry named after the Babylonian god to whom children were sacrificed. But Ginsberg's antinomianism has been, like Whitman's, the wound dresser, adhesive, sowing a communal purpose. So Ginsberg helped organize the peace marchers in the 60s, was witness to the Chicago National Convention in 1968, along with his friend William S. Burroughs, who may be the most antinomian of all the Beats. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who was arrested for publishing Hal, Ferlinghetti, whose City Lights books is antinomian mecca of the world. Ferlinghetti, whose A Coney Island of the Mind has sold more copies than any book of poetry by any living American poet, Ferlinghetti, antinomian to the end, sees the poet as enemy of the state. The antinomian legacy of Whitman, Pound, Miller, Kerouac, Ginsberg, Burroughs, Ferlinghetti, and so many other poets, writers, musicians, leads to our door, and in this final moment, having stood in the shadows for too long, we step out, and now we stand on the brink, on the edge, at the ending of time. Time was, time is, time will be no more. And it's the Big Bang epiphany in the gap between thought and image, voices, dreams racing, whispering through our blood, pleading through our blood. strange activities of our nerves, the unconscious life of our minds, a tetrameter of I-ams marching, shouting, voices without restraint, alchemically transmutative symbol decipherment, the book as sacred elixir, manger du livre, eat the book. The shortest distance between two points is a creative distance, and Allen Ginsberg howls, I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, and Diane de Prima rants, the only war that matters is the war against the imagination. All other wars are subsumed in it. And a Mary Baraka chants, they have turned and say that I am dying, that I have thrown my life away. They have left me alone where there is no one, nothing save who I am, not a note nor a word. And Lawrence Ferlinghetti paints pictures of the gone world. Allen Ginsberg, Diane de Prima, Mary Baraka, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, numinous howls and rants and chants and paintings and years of tears come fiercely flowing, streaming. All the pain wells up, years of failure, of not being enough for anyone, years of wandering, lost on the outside, outlaw, being told, you ain't shit, you don't fit, what the hell you doing here? All you've done is create pain and sorrow. Wouldn't you be better off dead? Turning away from, walking away from, disappearing from authorities, the past, the dead. In the hermetic corridors of authority, the dead somberly splash in their shallow sewers, devouring and regurgitating themselves. And with tears in my eyes, a snarl on my lips, and peace in my heart, I'm falling. I'm failing as no others dare fall or fail. And I'm in the gap between thought and image. How'd I get here after all the years of not being self? After all the years of being other, of floating out of my body, on the ceiling, watching skin, blood, bones, nerves, going through the motions, believing in space and time without realizing I was already out of sync, beyond chaos, breathing rhythms at the ending of time. And now, here, in the gap between thought and image, where the only distance is creative distance, here, now, at the ending of time, I focus all three eyes in wolf fashion, closing time. I walk through the stone called lump of fat, and I float through the fire that is central, and I enter the upper chamber of the Golden Pyramid, the confluence of all streams, polyglot commingling of all voices. Thalos feeds herself, and as I float over the open sarcophagus, I am the ocean of consciousness. Newt Thompson, progenitor of modernism, recipient of the 1920 Nobel Prize for Literature, in his 1890 essay on the unconscious life of the mind, said, we would experience a little of the secret movements which are made unnoticed in the remote places of the soul, the capricious disorder of perceptions, the delicate life of fantasy held under the magnifying glass, the wanderings of these thoughts and feelings out of the blue, motionless, trackless journeys with the brain and the heart, strange activities of the nerves, the whispering of the blood, the pleating of the bone, the entire unconscious life of the mind. Art is a kind of innate drive that seizes a human being and makes her or him its instrument. The artist is not simply a person acting freely in pursuit of a merely private end, but one who allows art to realize its purposes through her or his person. Artists have moods, free will, personal aims, but as artists, they are bearers of a collective humanity, carrying and shaping the common unconscious life of the species. So what? So what is the ocean of consciousness? The only war that matters is the war against the imagination. All other wars are subsumed in it. The psychic makeup of creative persons attracts attention, but the actual artistic achievement is the bedrock of inquiry when it is directed toward understanding the artist, for the artistic disposition adheres to a charisma that attaches to the office and has collective aspects. To be an artist is to fail as no other dare fail. Today, specialization is sold on every corner, fed in every home, brainwashed into every student, every young person. We are told that the only way to succeed here at the beginning of the 20th century is to put all our time, energy, learning, and focus into one area, one field, one specialty, math, science, computer technology, business. If we don't, we will fail. We are subtly and forcefully, implicitly and explicitly encouraged to deny the rest of who we are, our total self, selves, selves, our holistic being. The postmodern brave new world seems to reside inside the computer via the web with only faint peripheral recognition to the person, the individual, and by extension, the real global community, the real human being operating the machine. The idea of and belief in specialization as the only path, only possibility, has sped up the fragmentation, the alienation, which began to grow rapidly within the individual, radically reshaping culture a century ago with the birth of those Machiavellian revolutions in technology, industry, and war. And with the growing fracturing, fragmentation, and alienation comes the path. Anger, fear, and angst, ennui, nihilism, depression, despair, that, for the person of action, leads to suicide. Unless, through our paradoxical leap of creative faith, we engage ourselves in the belief, which can become a life mission, that regardless of the consequences, we can, through our engagement, our actions, our loving life work, make the world a better, safer, friendly in which to live. Sound naive? What does this have to do with Voices Without Restraint, with the Beat Generation, with the so-called and sadly mislabeled Generation X, with the youth of today? What place does the antinomian voice, the voice of the Beat Generation, the voice that, though trembling, speaks out against the powers that be, what place does this outsider voice have in the real violent world in which we are immersed? Are we too desensitized to the violence, to the fact that in the past century alone, we have murdered over 160 million people in one war after another, to even think it worthwhile to consider the possibility of a less violent world? Are we too small, too insignificant to make any kind of difference? The power mongers have control. What difference can one little individual life possibly make, possibly matter? Today, the X and micro-surf generations are swollen with young people yearning to express the creative energies buried in their hearts, seeping from every pore of their beings. They ache to change, to heal the world. Is it still possible? Is it too late? Is there anyone, a group, left to show the way, to be an example, to be a guide, a mentor? James Joyce, king of modernism, said the idea of the hero was nothing but a damn lie, that the primary motivating forces are passion and compassion. As late as 1984, people were laughing at George Orwell. Today, as we finally move into an Orwellian culture of simulation life on the screen landscape, can we remember passion and compassion? Or has the postmodern, ironic, satiric, death and life game killed both sperm and egg? Is there anywhere worth going from here? Is it any wonder that today's youth have adopted Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, William S. Burroughs, Herbert Hunke, Gregory Corso, Neil Cassidy, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Mary Baraka, Robert Creeley, David Amram, Diane De Prima, Ed Sanders, Ann Waldman, Bob Dylan, and all the other Beat Generation and related poets, writers, artists, musicians as their inspirational, life-affirming antinomian ancestors? These are people who have stood and still stand up against unreasoning power, right, might, looked that power in the eyes and said, "No, I don't agree with you, and this is why." And they have spoken these words not for money or for fame, but out of life's deepest convictions, out of the belief that we, each one of us, no matter our skin color, our economic status, our political, religious, sexual preferences, all of us have the right to live, to dream as we choose, rather than as some supposed higher moral authority prescribes for us. In the next decade, the Beats will come to be recognized as the most important group of writers and poets in the history of America. The Beats have given birth to new generations, to new energies, which are awakening to the realization that the creative imagination provides salvation from suicide, from death in life, by revealing that there are alternative paths to explore in this world, alternative paths that lead away from the mundane, the superficial, away from submission to mediocrity, alternative paths opening into the inspired, brilliant fire called life. The hollow doors of academia, the bastion of conservative thought, the doors of academia are finally opening, just as it took so long for them to open to James Joyce, Virginia Woolf, Samuel Beckett, and all the other original thinkers and expressionists. The doors are creaking open, and finally, at least a discourse on the Beats has begun. I am more than my physical body, and as such, I can see more than the physical world. Produce, produce, produce. Young people of all ages, let go your fears. Embrace failure. Take risk. Accept responsibility for your own actions. Embrace failure. Through failure, you will know undreamed of success. Mysticus memoria, rhythmus, ignis fatuus, weaving wisp of memory beyond the thread of time. Ocean of the forgotten fleet with mystic memory rhyme. Unseen sirens sing within the pilfered soul. Orchestrated rhythms of wind and drum. Ride the blood crest to the heart. Move with word thoughts distant. Touch the untouchable emotion womb. Chordate core at the core of Om. If history is the embodiment of fear, reason, social convention, and tradition, then it becomes the duty, the responsibility, the compelling creative urge of the Nabi, the prophet, to crack history's encrusted iconostasic shell, releasing the dying and dead by invocation of the word. Pure thought translated via pure energy into meaningful sound. The prophet becomes poet, which in Greek means maker, creator, and as poet whose home is in shadow, in the holy, unholy, the sacred and the profane realms of the creative imagination, as the synaptic link between spirit and matter creates a new, enlightened, awake world. Out of the postmodern surreal chaos will evolve a structure more vast than presently perceivable that I call the ocean of consciousness. The structure is difficult to perceive because we are the structure. We are the synthesis. All streams of thought of con and unconsciousness flow to our ocean of consciousness, the structure that gives birth to, engulfs, encloses, creates, and expands the chaos. Where do we, do I, myself, all of me, including my spirit and soul, begin and end? Do we begin? Do we end? The earth was once thought of as the center of the universe, but our view, our perception, thrown out into the creative imagination like a boomerang, expanded and is now returning. And we will soon see that we, each one of us, are the center of a vast, interconnected, perhaps infinite universe. My quest to reach beyond modernism and postmodernism to the ocean of consciousness may be partially defined as a literary, scientific, alchemical mysticism in which the Mysterium Tremendum is alive and doing well. It is a creative, numinous attempt to reach a fourth kingdom beyond, but encompassing the alienating realms of spirit, matter, chaos, a fourth kingdom wherein lies the synthesis of apparently irreconcilable differences. The journey is inward, outward, centered, liminal, in the heart, and on the edge, to silence, to the immaterial, psychological, emotional, mental, spiritual self, but also simultaneously to the spoken, visual, material, the world of action. But the emphasis of the journey is inward, with the self, soul, consciousness at heart. Knowledge from the inception of modernism and through postmodernism and chaos to the ocean of consciousness is reorganized, redefined through literature, art, music, and film. The genres are changing, the canons are exploding, as is culture. The mythopoetics, the privileged sense of sight of modern, contemporary, avant-garde poets, musicians, artists, filmmakers are examples of art forms of a society, a culture, a civilization, a world in which humanity lives not securely in cities nor innocently in the country, but on the apocalyptic, simultaneous edge of a new realm of being and understanding. The mythopoet, female and male, returns to the role of prophet seer by creating myths that resonate in the minds of readers, myths that speak with the authority of the ancient myths, myths that are gifts from the shadow.